I'm not a hunter, but I'm told that in places like in the Arctic, where indigenous people sometimes might hunt a wolf, they'll take a double-edged blade and they'll put blood on the blade and they'll melt the ice and stick the handle in the ice so that only the blade is protruding, and that a wolf will smell the blood and wants to eat, and it'll come and lick the blade trying to eat. And what happens is when the wolf licks the blade, of course, he cuts his tongue and he bleeds and he thinks he's really having a good meal. He drinks and he licks and of course he's drinking his own blood and he kills himself. That's what the imperialists did to us with crack cocaine. You got these young brothers out there thinking that they're getting something that they're going to make a living with. They're getting something they can buy a car like the white people have cars. Why can't I have a car? They're getting something so they can get a piece of gold. The white people have gold. Why can't I have gold? They're getting something to get a house. The white people have a house. Why can't I have a house? And they actually think that it's something that's bringing resources to them, but they're killing themselves just like the wolf who's licking the blade, and they're slowly dying without knowing. That's what's happening to the community. You with me on that? That's exactly and precisely what happens to the community. And instead of blaming the hunter who put the damn handle and the blade in the ice for the wolf, that what happens is the wolf gets blamed for trying to live. That's what happens in our community. You don't blame the person, the victim, you blame the oppressor. Imperialism, white power is the enemy. Well, the enemy, when it first came to Africa, snatched up the first African, brought us here against our will, is the enemy today. That's the thing that we have to understand.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
We'll do everything possible to reduce the serious threat to our society.
For a national crusade against drugs.
Our most serious problem today is cocaine, and in particular, crack.
The only thing I would say about that is we're in real trouble on that.
Who's responsible?
Crack cocaine first hit the west coast of the United States in the early 1980s and swept across America at an epidemic pace. In August of 1996, San Jose Mercury News reporter Gary Webb wrote a series of articles entitled Dark Alliance, which substantiated claims that California coke dealers with connections to Nicaraguan Contra rebels were responsible for introducing crack into black neighborhoods of south-central Los Angeles in the early 80s. This drug trafficking was done in tandem with the CIA, who condoned the activity in order to help facilitate the funding of Contra rebels with cocaine money. Webb's articles launched a firestorm which resonates still through the African-American community. It also evoked a fiery reaction from the media establishment who, under CIA pressure, denounced the series and demoted Gary Webb from his position at the San Jose Mercury News. Some journalists stopped short of calling the crack epidemic a conspiracy, rather stating that the CIA's mission was to make money for the Contras. The fact that crack destroyed entire communities of African Americans in the process was perhaps, in the words of Central Intelligence, collateral damage. Others see the introduction of crack into communities of color nothing short of genocide. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll be hearing excerpts from Gary Webb discussing his series Dark Alliance, as well as former LAPD narcotics agent Mike Rupert, to discuss what happens to whistleblowers, or people who speak out against the association that the CIA has with drugs in this country and around the world. Stay tuned for Circle A Radio.
What I found was that starting in the 70s in Peru, teenagers in middle-class neighborhoods started smoking this paste, this coca paste, and the scientists started writing about it because it turned them into, the kinds of things you see in Reefer Madness, these drug zombies that would walk around and that's all they would think about was getting their next fix, and this was literally true. They started warning the Americans at this conference in Lima in the summer of 79. The South Americans got together with the North American science cocaine experts and said, look, you've got a problem coming. You need to do something about it. And so the scientific community, led by Dr. Robert Bick of Yale, decided that this was a problem. and this was a real problem. And so he went to Congress and told them that there was going to be a massive drug epidemic coming within the next few years. It had already ravaged Bolivia, it was ravaging Peru, it was ravaging Colombia, and he had never seen anything like it in his life. And there were a number of scientists in South America that were very frightened about it. He suggested that the Congress start a public education campaign to warn people that this stuff was coming and don't get anywhere near it. And they thanked him for his testimony and then said, well, you know, how do we stop the Bolivians from growing coca plants? And how do we stop the Peruvians from growing coca plants? And he said, well, you know, it'd be easier to stop growing tobacco in Virginia. It's just never going to happen. But they ignored what he said, and they went on with this eradication strategy called the Andean strategy. And this is what we did. We tried to get people to stop growing plants. And crack came. And it first showed up in South Central Los Angeles, probably in the very late 70s. By 1982, drug users had perfected this to take it from freebasing, which was kind of dangerous to make, to this very safe, I think it was even called healthful method of making it with baking soda and water. And it started catching on among the very rich celebrities. It started catching on among the very rich drug dealer, because cocaine was so very expensive in the late 1970s and early 1980s. But when you turned it into crack, it became very cheap since you didn't need it. And cocaine started showing up in greater and greater amounts in the streets of Los Angeles in the early 80s. The men who were running the market down in L.A., this fellow Danilo Blandone, he told the CIA that when he started this operation down there, he was paid a visit initially by Enrique Bermudez, who was the CIA agent. He was on the CIA payroll. There was a military commander of the Contras at the time, this army called the FDN. And at this meeting, he told the Inspector General of the CIA, Bermudez told them that he wanted them to adopt the flag of the FDN. He wanted them to adopt the colors of the FDN. And he said from that point on, we were part of the FDN. We used their flag, we used their colors, we used their letterhead. And, you know, I really don't know what more you need to do to become a Contra than to accept the offer from the head of the Contras. It's not like this guy was his brother, his cousin or something. So they were an official part of the FDN, and the FDN's role with the CIA was essentially a wholly owned subsidiary. I mean, they wrote the agreement, they picked the name, they picked the officers, they wrote the press releases, they told them to take credit for battles that they had nothing to do with. And this is all laid out in Edgar Chamorro's monograph. I think it's called Packaging the Contras, which was just a brilliant expose of what was going on inside the Contras at the time. So you had drug traffickers who were members of the FDN, and these men were meeting with CIA agents, and they took, in this case, in Dark Alliance, they took their fundraising orders directly from the CIA agent, Enrique Bermudez, and nobody has denied that. I mean, that is undisputed. Blandone, who was at the meeting, says it happened. Norwin Meneses, who was his boss, who was also at the meeting, says it happened. Adolfo Calero says they had a meeting. Nobody's denying that this occurred. If you look at the history of the FDN, and which is what I did in the book, I tracked them back to their beginnings in Guatemala as the Legion of September 15. These guys were out there, and they were involved in contract killings. They were involved in kidnappings for money. I mean, these were warriors, and they didn't have a war to fight, and they needed to have a way to make a living. So they robbed, and they stole, and they thieved. And the CIA looked at them and said, that's just the kind of organization we need.
Can't tell me life was meant to be liked. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time there's violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years, they have fed you this. Foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Schools, churches.
Opium and cocaine traffickers have expanded their operations without fear of prosecution.
These covert operations seem to provide protection the traffickers often need.
All of this is justified in the name of national security.
Major drug smuggling on the part of the Contras. The Ilopango Air Base in El Salvador, they were flying on the John Holmes Ranch.
Drugs being used to finance the CIA war against Nicaragua.
The CIA station chief and people in the National Security Council are banned for life for introducing cocaine trafficking to Costa Rica.
It's important to draw a distinction between what these traffickers contributed personally out of their own pockets and what this drug ring produced. And in my series, I said that this drug ring sent millions of dollars down. And I based that on Blandone's testimony initially. And it's been since come out in the CIA Inspector General's report. They interviewed two of the men who actually took them down there. One of them they interviewed after George O'Dell and I interviewed him. In which he said he took down, I think it was between $4 and $5 million from the drug ring's operation in San Francisco, took it down to Costa Rica, took it down to Honduras, and delivered it, and he said, directly to a CIA agent whom he named as Ivan Gomez, and who the CIA, in its report, acknowledged that there was a CIA agent in Costa Rica during those years who was using the alias Ivan Gomez, so it was kind of hard for him to have made this up, I think. The other trafficker they interviewed, which I never talked to, was a fellow named Renato Peña Cabrera, who was the military representative of the FDN and the political representative of the FDN in San Francisco between 84 and 82. And he told the CIA Inspector General pretty much the same thing, that he made about 6 to 8 trips from San Francisco to Los Angeles. He carried between $500,000 and $1 million with him on each trip. And the men he was giving this money to told him that parts of this money was going to the Contras. He was a convicted cocaine trafficker. He became a government witness. The CIA, I don't think, found anything to contradict him. So I think it's a lot more accurate to you. I mean, I have no idea how many millions, and I have no idea how much of these millions actually went to the soldiers in the field and how much of it was used by these CIA agents down there to buy houses and girlfriends and gamble. But, I mean, the money was going down there, and it was going down there in large amounts.
The dope money from these various operations is washed through major money center banks.
No.
BCCI.
Nugenhand.
The Panamanian banking industry.
Certainly, Panama has been a major center of narco traffic, but that's been primarily the banks.
We removed Noriega.
Last night, I ordered U.S. military forces to Panama.
We installed the Andorra government with a cabinet with a multiplicity of links to the Panamanian banking industry, which is Panama's key function in the cocaine traffic.
The newspapers are not about to tell you what's really going on.
Medellin cartel recruits, trains, and finances paramilitary assassination groups. They are part of the oligarchy that rules Colombia. They have formed direct alliances with the leaders of the military. The drug cartel is determined to wipe out progressive elements. The killings of trade union leaders, peasant union leaders, social activists, and progressive political figures.
Snort a line, kill a leftist.
Our government's running a war with drug money.
What, are you crazy? What the hell are you talking about?
The CIA has been responsible for major expansions in the heroin and cocaine trade through its covert operations.
I mean, who's responsible for all that?
The narco-industrial complex.
What is the dope business really all about?
Yeah, usually you got sort of a glimpse of the size of the operations when the police would stumble across these things. And I think one of the best examples happened in San Francisco in 83 when they broke open the Frogman case. And this was one ship that these frogmen were swimming cocaine ashore, and they had 430 pounds of it, which was the biggest drug bust in California history at that time. And that was just one ship. And I went over and I looked at the files of the Frogman investigation, and the FBI was watching ship after ship after ship from the same Colombian freight line, the Grand Colombiana line, go up and down the coast, dropping, you know, 50 kilos here, 100 kilos here, 300 kilos here, at Portland, at Seattle, at Los Angeles. So, you know, it was a big operation. And Meneses, Norman Meneses, who was the head of this ring, I mean, the CIA called him the drug kingpin of Nicaragua in the days of Somoza. So he was no little guy. The Meneses family was very, very powerful and very influential in the Somoza regime. His brother, Edmundo, was the chief of police of Managua for many years. He was a brigadier general in the Nicaragua National Guard. He later became Somoza's ambassador to Guatemala, where he was assassinated in 1978 by Guatemalan guerrillas who claimed essentially that he was coordinating counter-revolutionary efforts in that area. Norman had another brother named Furman, who was another general in the National Guard. Norwin was sort of the Al Capone of Nicaragua. He ran a lot of gambling places. He had whorehouses outside of town with waterbeds and videotape machines, which were like a novelty back then. And there were these drive-in places you can go into with girlfriends if you want. And then he had a marijuana business going. He had nightclubs going. And he could do anything he wanted because his brother's the chief of police. So, you know, it was sort of an open city. Landon was a minor official in the Nicaraguan government. He was the head of the wholesale, I think it was called the wholesale markets, director of wholesale markets. And his job, and this will become important later when he gets to L.A. and begins to set up a drug network, his job was to set up demonstration projects for wholesaling agricultural goods. He had an MBA in marketing, courtesy of the taxpayers of the United States, I might add, to create wholesale markets for agricultural products. And when the Sandinistas took over, both of these men left and came to the United States, which I can't figure out how a drug trafficker the size of Norman Meneses could have been welcomed into this country. Since the DEA knew he was a drug dealer since 72, 7 years later he waltzes in here and gets a work permit and a visa and applies for political asylum. And they started selling, you know, they continued selling drugs as Meneses had done for many years, only they started doing it for the Contras. And shortly after this happened, Blandón hooked up with this drug dealer in South Central named Freeway Ricky Ross, who at the time was about 19 or 20 years old, had tried to become a tennis player and was looking for a college scholarship, but the problem was he couldn't read or write, so it was a little difficult for a college to let him. Okay, and then he ran into an auto upholstery teacher at vocational school who was a cocaine user and a small-time dealer, and Rick got into the cocaine business that way and gradually worked his way up the ladder through the teacher's sources until he got to the top and connected with Danilo Blandón, the MBA in marketing. And they proceeded to sort of blanket South Central with cocaine.
How much did the DEA and U.S. government officials exactly know about Norwin Meneses and his drug trafficking background? Did they have a lot of detail about that?
They had a ton. I mean, I found a DEA affidavit in those files, which went on for 3 pages about what the FBI and what the DEA knew about him. And they knew he was a multi-kilo trafficker way, way back in the 70s. They had been following him all the way. They had found him in New Orleans in 79. They'd found him in Tampa. They'd run across him in Southern California. They had all of his nephews running around San Francisco being arrested with 20 pounds of cocaine here and 4 pounds here. And so they knew very well who he was.
Portland historian O.B. Hill.
In Portland, communities were transformed. In the area that I lived in, it affected residential areas, businesses, and individual families. I don't know of any family in those areas that was not impacted by crack cocaine and the byproducts of it.
Portland resident Carrie Connor.
Most of the kids who my brother grew up with are either dead or in jail from overdoses, or just from getting high on their own supply and then falling off and needing to, you know, go and do petty crimes so that they could continue to, you know, get high.
The impact of drugs is like a shock, an afterwave in our communities, if you may. And we're even seeing that today, but no one's talking about it. But the communities that were heavily impacted with crack cocaine, beginning with the introduction of this into central and south L.A. in 1982, when the market was saturated in the L.A. area, then different branches of these gangs sort of splintered off and started moving up and down the coast. In Portland, we began the phenomena of the Crips and the Bloods. They weren't known as such as there because what these people were instrumental in doing was going into local communities and influencing primarily high school students. As a result of that, my family was impacted by losing at least one person who was a nephew of mine. I remember crack houses coming up throughout the community, and a dear friend of mine died as a result of this. So people don't talk about that, but the impact, the aftershock, it reaches down to everybody's level.
I grew up in Park Slope in Brooklyn in the 80s when it was being actively gentrified and crack was being heavily introduced to New York neighborhoods. My parents grew up there and their parents grew up there. So, you know, it was a neighborhood in Brooklyn. You know, it was just like a place where people lived and, you know, went to work. A lot of, you know, locally owned businesses. The grocer down the street lived, you know, two blocks away. People knew each other. And when they started to gentrify the neighborhood, they actively moved those people out of the neighborhood so that they could move in the people who could afford to live there at the prices that they wanted to charge.
In Portland, the police bureau primarily had been located in either southeast, the downtown, and there was a branch out in North Portland that serviced the north and northeast community. But with the drug epidemic that swept through northeast Portland during these particular times, you were able to have the heart of the community torn out from a standpoint of commercial economic activity, especially retail. We see Fred Meyer's, which was the largest store in the community, completely shutting down. And this abandoned property, along with others along the King Boulevard at the time, set the stage for deterioration, whereby property values plummeted. The other thing, too, drug laws were enacted so that if you were an owner of a house that people were convicted of drugs, you could lose your property. So the city gained a lot of property that way.
When crack first came and became something that the people were, you know, the kids in the neighborhood were using to as their livelihood, it was such a consumer-driven culture. Everybody had to have name-brand this and name-brand that. People were dying in the streets because they had on, you know, $150 Jordan sneakers, and, you know, people were killing for them. It was that much of a status symbol. When you have this and constantly being inundated with it, that this is what you have to wear if you want to be cool, this is what you have to do, but you're showing this to people who don't have any money and don't have the means to get it, and then you dangle a little something in front of them to say, you know, oh, well, you know, you can make money doing this. You know, of course, they're going to jump at the chance. It's the ultimate product because you present it to people and, you know, it gives them such a rush that they'll work their ass off to get more. It, you know, made the neighborhood a violent place because people were trying to control this territory because there was a lot of money to be had. So they were able to sort of keep a lot of the property values down while the real estate companies snapped up these buildings that had typically been rent stabilized or rent controlled. They were able to move a lot of people out so that they could turn the building over and start charging exorbitant amounts of money for it. What they want to do when they gentrify a neighborhood, seeing the real estate companies, is buy up some property and sort of leave it vacant and allow for that to sort of create a somewhat of a criminal element, which will drive down other property values, make it easier for them to buy up the entire neighborhood. And then once they have a controlling interest in it, they can turn around and do some very basic, you know, rehabs of the properties and start selling them to, you know, people for much more money than they ever would have gotten had they just moved into the neighborhood. There was definitely some complicity on the part of the police department in that happening. It's a huge national organization that would really allow you to do something like that on a national level. I know a kid prominent in the crack trade in New York and ended up leaving New York for about 10 years and came back and went to his same hookup, who was a cop in Brooklyn, and, you know, was able to get more drugs off of him 10 years later. So it's, you know, very much entrenched in the police department. They've created this, you know, specter specifically in black neighborhoods so that, you know, they have cause to sort of be able to stop anybody and search them if they, you know, quote unquote, fit the profile because, oh, you don't want crack in your neighborhood. You can't have crack in your neighborhood when, you know, they were the ones who installed it in that neighborhood in the first place. You know, I mean, there's been cases like, you know, with Michael Dowd, you know, police officer in New York who organized his entire precinct to basically control the drug trade in that neighborhood. It's not something that, like, there's just a couple of cops who are just doing this, like, on a whim to make some money. It's definitely something that seems to be organized. They have an interest in keeping it in the neighborhood because if you dangle it out there in front of people who really don't have any money, of course they're going to take the chance at it. And the problem is it doesn't actually bring any wealth to these people. Brings them cash, which is completely different because that cash, you can't go and turn around and put it in a bank account or, you know, invest it because it's dirty money. So, you know, the people at the highest levels have a way that they can, you know, launder this money and put it into whatever they want to do it. But at the lowest levels, you have people who basically just have cash who can turn around and use it to buy more crack so that they can make more cash.
That was one of the problems with the young people, Crips and Bloods. They had no laundering mechanism. But the people who introduced it had a very good laundering mechanism, offshore banking accounts, etc. The other thing, too, a lot of money would be confiscated by local police bureaus who would take the money, and I don't know if any real accounting has ever came about the money made off of these drugs. Now we have a community that has totally, within a 15 to 20-year period, almost transitioned out to people not being able to afford to even stay there. From perspective of neighborhoods that are predominantly African American, these were not things that were unexpected. A lot of us face realities and see no solutions, and so drugs is a way out to sort of obfuscate any inkling of whatever the solution is. Just give me some of that and I'll disappear for a while. These connections and tactics have been used on people of color for an awfully long time.
And you've been listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM. Tonight we're discussing the association that the CIA has with drugs in this country and around the world. Stay tuned for more Circle A Radio. Portland historian O.B. Hill.
When you get into substances that are being abused, and then legislation comes into it, because The prison industrial complex is a growth industry. If you get young, ignorant, poor, primarily African Americans and Latinos involved in activities that you can really monitor relatively easy, and then you got another industry that's springing out of this. So what started out as trying to help so-called freedom fighters ended up entrapping people in this country and adding to the prison industrial complex.
Former Surgeon General Jocelyn Elder.
When one out of three young black men in this country are incarcerated or on parole, most related to nonviolent crime. Our greatest growth industry in this country since 1985 has been our prison industry. Most of our schools were built before 1985, and most of our prisons were built since 1985 to warehouse often young people related to drugs.
Prison activist Angela Davis.
The most likely people to go to prison in this country today are young African American men. A few years ago, there was a report that was done by the Sentencing Project indicating that about 25% of all young men between the ages of 18 and 24 or so were incarcerated. 25%. That was, I think, in 1991. A few years later, the Sentencing Project did a similar report and discovered that within 3 or 4 years, the percentage had soared to over 32%. And by now, that percentage has probably gone up. So we're talking about over one-third of all young black men in this country in prison or directly under the surveillance and control of the criminal justice system. Now, something is wrong with that. I mean, one of the problems, of course, is that as we see the material expansion of the criminal justice system, what I call the prison industrial complex, there is also an ideological campaign to persuade people that criminals can be recognized by virtue of their race.
Race is a determining factor as it relates to the type of drugs they use and the legal procedures that are used, so some may capitalize at the demise of other neighborhoods. There's a method to this madness if you really look at it. The prison industrial complex, what it does is provide work for rural areas to hit afford or losing their economic base. So prisoners are a very lucrative market. You build prisons in Pendleton, Ontario, other outlying areas, ship people out to these places, sends them to long terms, and it creates jobs. It also takes other people off the street who now have to work for free. So it's a reincarnation of slavery. And then, of course, we all know who the people who were enslaved were. It's the same people now who are having the problems with crack cocaine and violence in these various communities across the nation. Fire!
Despite the government's inability to formally discredit his findings, Gary Webb's articles caused a widespread campaign to smear his journalistic integrity. Few spectacles in journalism were more disgusting than the attacks on Webb in the New York Times, Washington Post, and Los Angeles Times. Under intense media pressure, San Jose Mercury editor Jerry Sipos sold out the story and demoted Webb, causing him to quit the Mercury. True to form, after Webb's series Dark Alliance raised a storm, particularly on black radio, the CIA issued categorical denials. Along with them came solemn pledges of a far-reaching investigation by CIA Inspector General Fred Hitz. On December 18, 1997, stories in the Washington Post and New York Times appeared simultaneously, both stating that Hitz had finished his investigation and found no direct or indirect links between the CIA and cocaine traffickers. The following is a discussion with investigative journalist Robert Perry.
If he had understood the kinds of attacks he might have come under, he could have maybe bulletproofed himself a bit. He was showing that these grand policy concepts of we got to be real hard-headed in our Cold War approach had real-world consequences on the streets of American cities. The quibbling that you got from the major papers was, well, you can't trace the entire crack cocaine epidemic to the Contra drugs. You can't prove that it was, so many tons. Because, you don't have invoices on this stuff. So you can't give a firm amount, although Gary's estimates of in the low millions was probably way underestimating what was being done when you look at the whole picture, whether that one channel he was looking at may have been involved to that level. But the broader picture, which has multiple channels of cocaine trafficking, were much more serious. But instead of looking at the bigger picture, the big three papers, the New York Times, Washington Post, and the LA Times, started to fly-spec Gary's story. And these same papers that had never put the Kerry report on page one, Kerry's report, as remarkable as it was buried deep inside all these papers. But when they finally put the Contra cocaine story on page one, it was in the context of attacking Gary Webb. And ironically, some of them would say sort of briefly one line saying, well, of course, we all knew that there was this Contra cocaine problem. It's also old news as well as being exaggerated and kind of crazy. But that was their approach. But then a remarkable thing happened. The anger of the black communities around the United States, as well as, the pressure that Webb tried to continue placing on it, led to these investigations. And although Webb was the pressure from the main papers had led his executive editor Jerry Sipos to essentially pull the rug out from under him and from their investigation. The investigation had been continuing at the San Jose Mercury News, and because of the pressure from these major news organizations, it was stopped. They had people in the field in Central America who were at risk. And they pulled the rug out from under all of them. They led him to resign from the paper. And then the Society of Professional Journalists gives an award to Jerry Sipos, an Ethics in Journalism Award, for doing what he did to Gary Webb. It was kind of everything we knew, we thought we want when we were kids about journalism on its head. Well, there's often been a very cozy relationship between especially prestige journalists in Washington and the intelligence community, the national security officials are often people who move in those same circles. And so there's a coziness. I'm not sure because it's not certainly the worst example of this. There are people like, Howie Kurtz, for instance, who is a well-known, perhaps one of the most prominent media critics in the United States. He, of course, is a media critic for the Washington Post, but he's even probably better known for his CNN shows. And he, when he was attacking Gary Webb, And I think the point that they make, people make of Gary Webb, is that, well, he made some errors. There were some nuances that were off, the gray areas or whatever, and that therefore it was justified to ridicule him and destroy his career and essentially ruin his life. But that those kinds of rules don't apply when it's, say, Howie Kurtz. And one of the points I've made in the piece I did for Consortium News was when Howie Kurtz was making fun of Gary Webb, there was a point where when Kurtz got hold of Webb's a book proposal that Webb had been making, and in it Webb had said something to the effect that he was going to look at the possibility that for some of the Contras this had become really a business. And Howie Kurtz, in his column in the Washington Post, included the line, Oliver Stone, check your voicemail, to show how utterly ludicrous Gary Webb had gotten, how conspiratorial and nutty. Well, the only problem was that anyone who actually covered the Contra War, and it was a fairly big issue in the 80s, would have known that many Contras did see it as a business. They were basically making money off it. And in fact, this was known inside the Reagan-Bush administration, was known inside the White House. And there was a fairly well-known memo that Rob Owen, who was the eyes and ears for Oliver North in Central America, sent to the White House, which made exactly that point and said the you know, that for many of the Contra leaders, this is just a business. And it was in capital letters in the memo, and I repeated it in this story. But no one expects Howie Kurtz, he obviously made a mistake here. He was wrong. He ridiculed Gary Webb on a factual point. Howie Kurtz, the media critic, was absolutely dead wrong on it. No one expects Howie Kurtz to have his career ruined over this. No one says that he should be fired or humiliated or have his life ruined because he screwed up. And this is a case of a real screw-up, not some nuanced gray area. Howie Kurtz got it wrong. But there's a double standard. For Gary Webb, it was he had to be perfect. For Howie Kurtz, he can kind of say whatever he wants. And it wasn't really until Gary Webb went through his ordeal, which, despite the pain for Gary, provoked investigations at the Department of Justice and CIA. And those investigations, if people actually read them, not just read the press releases, would show that there was not just the problem that Gary Webb pointed to, but the Contra drug problem was far, far bigger, involving more than 50 Contras and Contra entities. And involving some of the major cartels that were moving drugs to the United States during that period. Then you go from Gary Webb being sort of essentially forced out of journalism, right. And there was great pleasure from the major papers over this. It was like they were proven to be correct. You know, Jerry Sipos had dumped this guy, you know, aha. There was a lot of almost king of champagne glasses attitudes at these major news organizations. And then, however, these reports started coming out in 1998. And perhaps even more remarkable was this, that each of the reports contained extraordinarily important news. And all these papers would do is sort of take the press releases, which tended to try to put the CIA in the best possible light, and focus on them. They did not apparently even read these reports, which contained remarkable admissions, historically important admissions. And then it got to the final one. And then it was interesting, when you get to the summer of 98, the New York Times is now getting wind that the volume two is really pretty damning. And so they do kind of a little bit of a scuttle to the side, and they do a front page story saying, well, we understand that maybe there was more to this than we had thought before, but then they went on. That was half the story. Half the story was to attack Gary Webb some more. And so that's where that stood until the report came out, released in October of 1998 on their website, ironically. There was just a huge amount of damning evidence in this report, And one could say that it still required going through it, putting some of it together. Like many government reports, it was a little bit scattered. Some pieces had to be kind of reconstructed because some things were at the end that maybe should have been at the beginning. But that's the kind of work journalists do. So when that came out, there was, you know, I rushed to download it off the internet because I thought they'd be so competitive. I was doing my website, consortiumnews.com, and we had been following these stories as they came out. I was talking to Gary, as different reports came out. I kept saying, gee, Gary, you really screwed this story up. You were much too kind. It was much worse than you thought. But when this final report came out, I rushed to download it, read it, and analyze it, and put together a story. And I thought, well, tomorrow morning I'm going to pick up these papers, and this is going to be on the front page. Except it wasn't. And eventually, you know, a couple of days later, the New York Times chugged out with an inside-the-paper story that wasn't, it was kind of a rewrite of their summer story, but didn't really move it very far. It was kind of a kiss-off. A month afterwards, the Washington Post came along with an inside-the-paper story that kind of misrepresented the report, basically. The L.A. Times, which had been sort of ground zero in this whole thing, never reported on the existence of this report after it was issued. I did a small piece saying it was going to come out, but then when it came out, they never did a story. The major news organizations really lead the way in making fun of people. That's the frame they put this in. Crazy Gary Webb or nutty Maxine Waters. You know, there's always some way of framing the issue in this very derogatory way to the people who are trying to dig out the facts.
Talking with Michael Rupert about many things, what happens to whistleblowers or people who speak out about the association that the CIA has with drugs in this country and around the world.
I became exposed to CIA operations. They tried to recruit me twice, and I discovered they were dealing drugs. Now, the second time that they tried to recruit me was after I was already on LAPD, and the recruitment took place by my fiancée, who was a CIA agent. And I basically discovered that the agency was dealing drugs to fund covert operations. In my case, I made the discovery in New Orleans in the summer of 1977, 20 years ago. A year later, as a result of objecting, I was basically forced out of LAPD under death threat. So the ostracism there is extremely painful sometimes.
Okay. There are others.
Yeah.
All right.
Many.
There are newspaper people. Yes. DEA agents.
Yes.
The most recent is a man by the name of Gary Webb. Now, Gary Webb went from being a celebrity for breaking the biggest story that I think in the last 40 years in this country,
yep,
to a guy now that allegedly or supposedly has to drive 150 miles to work every day.
And he's covering dog stories, you know, dog groomings and the new baby tiger at the zoo in Cupertino and, you know, the flower shop and... And there's a very distinct reason why they do things like this. One of my biggest heroes is a guy named Fletcher Prouty, who was Mr. X and Oliver Stone's JFK. He's written many, many books. And he talks about object lessons. And it's like he uses LBJ as an example. LBJ was in the motorcade when the bullets that shot Kennedy, and Johnson was never able to forget that those bullets could just as easily have hit him.
In the motorcade, he sees Kennedy get blown away.
Mm-hmm.
So what kind of president is he going to be?
Obedient.
I mean, let's face it.
Yeah.
He's not going to... Every time he thinks of doing anything against the military-industrial complex, anything against the Wall Street guys, anything against corporate America, anything against the multinational corporations, he's going to think twice.
So Gary Webb is an object lesson. He's now driving 150 miles one way to work.
On Friday, December 10th, Gary Webb, 49, died of an apparent suicide, a gunshot wound to the head. Whatever the details of Webb's death, American history owes him a huge debt. Though denigrated by much of the national news media, Webb's contra-cocaine series prompted internal investigations by the Central Intelligence Agency and the Justice Department, probes that confirmed that scores of Contra units and Contra-connected individuals were implicated in the drug trade. The probes also showed that the Reagan-Bush administration frustrated investigations into those crimes for geopolitical reasons. To this day, no editor or reporter who missed the Contra drug story has been punished for his or her negligence. Indeed, many of them are now top executives in their news organizations. On the other hand, Gary Webb's career never recovered. At Webb's death, however, it should be noted that this great gift to American history was that he, along with angry African-American citizens, forced the government to admit some of the worst crimes ever condoned by any American administration. The protection of drug smuggling into the United States as part of a covert war against a country, Nicaragua, that represented no real threat to Americans. The truth was ugly. Certainly the major news organizations would have come under criticism themselves if they had done their job and laid out this troubling story to the American people. Conservative defenders of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush would have been sure to howl in protest. But the real tragedy of Webb's historic gift, and of his life cut short, is that because of the major news media's cowardice, this dark chapter of the Reagan-Bush era remains largely unknown to the American people. Gary Webb deserves to be remembered in the proud tradition of muckrakers like Ida Tarbell, George Seldes, and I.F. Stone. In this era of embedded reporters, an unembedded journalist like Gary Webb will be sorely missed.
Gary Webb's book is called Dark Alliance. For more information about him, you can go to consortiumnews.com or counterpunch.com. Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. You can always contact us at info@circlearadio.org with questions and comments. We're on the air every first and third Wednesday from 6 to 7 on your KBOO. Stay tuned for DJ audio and nonstop hip-hop. You.
I'm in trouble.